Sahana Vavatu Sahanau Bhunaktu Sahavaryankaravavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastoma Vidyavishavahai Om Shanti 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 Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sarigaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Page 5 Bhagavatam verse reference. The word avyakta refers to the body and not pradhan, as the atheistic Shankya philosophers argue. This passage compares the body to a chariot. Srimad Bhagavatam 7.15.41. Transcendentalists who are advanced in knowledge compare the body, which is made by the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to a chariot. The senses are like the horses, the mind, the master of the senses, is like the reins. The objects of the senses are the destinations. Intelligence is the chariot driver, and consciousness, which spreads throughout the body, is the cause of bondage in this material world. 7.15.42. The 10 kinds of air acting within the body are compared to the spokes of the chariot's wheel, and the top and bottom of the wheel itself are called religion and irreligion. The living entities in the bodily concept of life is the owner of the chariot. The Vedic mantra pranava is the bow. The pure living entity himself is the arrow, and the target is the supreme being. Footnote 4. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments. The 10 times of prana are the spokes. Prana, apana, samana, vyana, udana, naga, kurma, krikala, devadatta, and dananjaya. They say the conditioned jiva is the passenger. Om is the valuable bow obtained by the mercy of Guru. The pure jiva is the arrow aimed at the Supreme Brahman. As an arrow is aimed with a bow and shot at a target, the jiva is shot at Brahman by uttering Om.
How is this related to our avyakta?
Just showing that it means it's talking about the body, it's not talking about pradhan. But in the metaphor, the chariot, if one aims at Brahman, then Brahman becomes the enemy. The enemy climbing the chariot is pierced by an arrow. Is the Brahman the enemy of the jiva because Brahman binds the jiva by its maya shakti? Right? It's the doubt. Simply by constantly thinking of him, the enemies of the Lord attain the same supreme truth, whom sages fixed in yoga worship by controlling their breath, mind, and senses. Srimad Bhagavatam 10.74.23. It is true that by having enmity for the Lord, one can obtain the equivalency of the liberation that sages desire. Some say that the Supreme Lord gives both the jnani and the enemy liberation on seeing the small amount of secondary bhakti included within jnana, and the assistance that the enemies give to the Lord in experiencing the happiness of vira rasa, since both the enemies and the jnanis fire arrows at the Lord. Others say in aiming at the Paramatma, they are like those who aimed at the fish in the wheel at Draupadi Swayamvara ceremony. Just as Arjuna pierced the target with an arrow by the strength of his arms and attained Draupadi, the jnanis attain liberation by the strength of their bhakti. Thus they are not real enemies. Sardartha Darshan. Right? So the difficulty comes up is because there's the tendency to try to literally deal with words. Right? It means they have a direct meaning, but it has to be direct meaning in the context of what's going on. So we have to be careful that when we're dealing with the direct meanings, that we don't then put it in the context that we're used to using that direct meaning. Right? Because it's our interpretation how we're using it that makes the difference. Right, so here in this case, then, the concept is being brought up that you're shooting arrows at someone, then that means they're an enemy. So then that kind of mood, would that be part of the whole process that we're talking about here? That's the doubt that comes up. But that's because they're taking it literally here. It means that you have a target, and you're shooting at a target. It's not that the target's the enemy, the target's the goal. And so through the bow, or through the omkara, through the knowledge of the Lord, the service of the Lord, remembering the Lord, that's how the pure jiva is going to attain the Lord. Right? That's what it means by this. But then it's taken literally that, okay, we're shooting at the Lord, so therefore he must be the enemy, so then why would that work? But he's saying, even if you want to take it that way, then it still would work. Because the demons who then are aimed at the Lord, and the jnanis who are aimed at the Lord, then they see the Lord in an inimical way, but they still attain liberation. So the position of liberation is going to happen anyway, if it's aimed at the Lord. But what we're talking about is that devotional element that's there, because even there, obtaining that position is coming from devotion. Right? It may not be favorable devotion, it may not be their intent is devotion, but there has to be some devotion when they apply the process of jnana or the process of being an enemy of Krishna, right? Because devotional, one of the devotional processes is always remembering the Lord. So they're practicing that. Just that they're not doing it to please the Lord. They're doing it out of fear of the Lord, right? Kamsa remembers Krishna 24/7. So he's following that practice of bhakti. Does that make sense? So to perform the process, any karma jnana, then one must use bhakti to make it work. Yes.
There are like Muslim terrorists that claim to be doing what they're doing, like suicide bombers and stuff, that are doing what they're doing for God, and they're so devotional to the cause that they're willing to even kill themselves, or they're at constant war with the enemy, which is their version of Maya, the Western world, and they're all doing that for the pleasure of God, and they're theistic. So is that bhakti, or is that sins, even though it's not scriptural?
No, anything, what we're talking about bhakti here means you're using the element of bhakti to attain something.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if we want to say, okay, they're doing all this to please God, but at the end of the day, who's going to be managing the place? Who's going to be controlling all the facilities and enjoying them?
Yeah.
Yeah. So is it actually about pleasing God?
But in their shastra, it says that they've got to have this war.
That's one interpretation of what their shastra says. See, there's, if you look at it historically, their position and the position of the Nazi Germany is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Ottoman Empire was very big, very powerful. They were quite liberal. They were probably the most liberal of all, you know, what was going on at the time. Because you could practice any religion, they didn't care. Then, at one point, because they're totally absorbed in sense gratification and everything like that, then the whole thing falls apart. Now, people aren't, you know, it means, of course, they're going to feel bad. It fell apart. Their empire's not there anymore. And so, you know, they'll just feel bad, so nothing happens. But then somebody comes along, I'm not sure what his name was, but it's Watabi, or it's not Wasabi, but it's basically that effect. But it's something like that with a W. It's one interpretation. So their point is that the reason that this all happened is because of all these other religions and all that. They undermined our great empire, therefore we lost our empire, therefore if we're at war with all of them, then everything will come back into it. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
So same with the Germans. They had their empire, everything fell apart, so then you have to, you know, blame the Jews, the gypsies, the gays, all these kind of people. That's because of them, that's why it fell apart.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
So that starts then, that's war with the world.
Yeah.
You know? So it's not that that's what their scriptures say, because most of anyone outside of that, they don't say that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Anyone outside, like that's...
It means anybody outside of that more radical interpretation, even though they're very religious, they never say that's the whole point. It's supposed to be the peaceful, because otherwise why was the Ottoman so liberal towards others?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's the thing. Aurangzeb, he was very, very radical. Why? The empire was falling apart. He was the last Muslim emperor. So that's the whole thing, is that when things fall apart, then they turn to that, because radicalness then is things aren't working in the standard way, because they're working by just the rules. They're not understanding the rules and what the purpose of the rule is. So therefore the externals. So it's the same point that's here. Those that are working by the externals, then they'll see in these ways. They'll take it that, oh, but you're saying they're an enemy, or they are an enemy, or these different things like that. So the principle comes down is that what's the purpose of the interpretation?
Yeah.
Right?
They're just drowning and they're trying to grab
on. Is it like that? So the whole point is they're saying it's the West, but the point is technically speaking, they say it's the Western world, but actually they don't like any other Muslims either. So, in other words, their interpretation is the only religious understanding. Everything else, including the other way people are following Islam, is not bona fide.
Yeah.
So it's not that it's the Western world, it's this, that, it's so many things like that. Just like you see in Christianity, which Christian group likes another Christian group? You know what I'm saying? Protestants don't like the Catholics, and both of them may have problem with the Oriental. Like that, within that they have divisions. Each one of those divisions think the other one is going to hell. So basically speaking, if you're a Christian, the faith is only your denomination is going to, you know, heaven. Everybody else is going to hell. So, you know, so we say there's, you know, 2 billion Christians, but the point is how big are each of those denominations? You know, and within that, then, you know, Catholicism, I think, has over 200 subdivisions. So are all of those good? You know, so, you know, do they consider each other one okay? Or do they also have problems? Or, you know, so like that. So that's the difficulty, is that each one thinks the other one's not, you know. Yeah, that's always. So that's the problem, is because there's not a real understanding of God. But the point is to have any success in anything, you still have to have that devotion, right? So it's just like, okay, you want to do your business nicely, okay? The person's absorbed in their business. But they have to hear and chant about that. They have to remember about that. They have to take care of everything, pot of saving that's there. They have to do all these things. You understand? You know, that full surrender to the business, Atman Nivedana. You know, that's why it works, is they're using the form of bhakti.
Yeah, right.
It's not that they have devotion as such,
but
they're following the process. Because the point is, and one's saying, okay, they're following this process, but if they're not following it with actual, you know, sincere devotion and surrender, why should they get a result? Because all they're getting is the secondary result. So getting facility, getting liberation, that's secondary. What's the big deal? Whoopee, you're still in the material world. You know what I'm saying? So that's the thing. That's like, what do you call it? You know, giving the example of, you know, you have a boil on your knee and then you move it to the other knee. You know, because then this knee gets a little rest, you know. That's all it is that you get tired of karma, so then you go for gyan, and then when you get tired of gyan, you go back for karma.
Yeah. Makes it look like you're going somewhere.
Yeah, but more. Yeah, but it's once no one's going anywhere.
Yeah.
Understand? So, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So, your own is the goal, and the target is the Supreme Brahman. So, basically,
yes.
Om and Brahman are one and the same meaning. So, it's like.
Yes. So. But the point is there anything other than Krishna?
Mm-hmm.
So then, what are you going to use? Yeah. So that's the process. What does Om mean? We're saying Brahman, but what does Om mean?
The Lord Indra.
Yes. So that means that whole process, but it means also the Dham, their pastimes. That means interaction. So that devotion to the Lord, that will get you there. So if you have that sampradayic devotion, then that will get you to the spiritual realm. If you just are using devotional service materially, that will get you to liberation of heavenly facilities. Is that clear? Okay. 7:15:45. As long as one has to accept a material body with its different parts and paraphernalia, which are not fully under one's control, One must have the lotus feet of his superiors, namely a spiritual master and the spiritual master's predecessors. By their mercy, one can sharpen the sword of knowledge, and with the power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's mercy, one must then conquer the enemies mentioned above. In this way, the devotee should be able to merge into his own transcendental bliss, and then he may give up his body and resume his spiritual identity. Footnote 5. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains here, that there are two types of knowledge. One kind to achieve liberation, and the other type to achieve bhakti. Ooh. It's like you have perfected the footnote. We've never come this close before. This is like perfection.
The line of it.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's it. There's only the line. You know, this is like the perfection, footnote. That's all there is the bottom line. Wow. I mean, we've gotten down to like a paragraph or a sentence, but this is not.
We had one word.
One word. Okay, we had one word. So yes, I had to work at it. Got it. 99.9 like that. Now I got it.
The next level is 2 pages of pure footnote.
Yeah. Yeah, true.
Not there yet.
Yeah, yeah. With just the line at the next page. Okay. Okay. So what was the context then? Okay, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur here explains there are two types of knowledge, one kind to achieve liberation and another type to achieve bhakti. After defeating the enemy, one gives up the chariot, bow, and arrow. Right? We're saying we're shooting it at the Lord, but it's our polluted consciousness. That concept is actually the enemy. The Lord is the one who's going to free us from that difficulty. The jnani gives up jnana, his sadhana for liberation, since it is a covering composed of prakriti, and then merges with Paramatma by the small portion of pure bhakti included in his practice of jnana. He does not give up that bhakti. One must reject both jnana and ajnana, since they are functions of maya shakti, in order to merge with Paramatma by the functioning of the Lord's Surup Shakti. They say that Om is the bow, the arrow of the jiva aimed at the Brahman, the arrow separating from the bow and chariot enters the target by the force of the person shooting the arrow. Similarly, the pure jiva giving up the impure jiva with its body, senses, and avidya, and giving up vidya in the form of Om, which causes knowledge for liberation. By the strength of a small amount of pure bhakti residing in the impure jiva, the pure jiva realizes Paramatma and merges into him. Right? So, because the point is when we say mixed bhakti, it means that it's pure bhakti mixed with something that's not pure, right? With karma jnana. Does that make sense? So that's what he's talking about here. That because he says that small amount of pure bhakti. Because the point is that the jiva, it's natural to understand there's a superior position that one must be surrendered to, right? And so in doing that, they follow the sadhana, they practice the knowledge, everything like that. But the point, the result of knowledge is it can give liberation. Right? That's the side benefit of knowledge. So the knowledge itself, that's why we say the jnani's merging or liberation is just a part of knowledge. Right? That's why we don't take it and put it into the forefront. Many will then interpret this that, oh, we don't worry about studying, right? So that's how the sahajiyas will interpret it. No, it means that knowledge as a goal, that's not taken as important. Knowledge is used to understand our position to the Lord and then surrender to that Lord. So then that means that particular kind of knowledge, that is burnt up in the process. Right? Just like the example given of fire and firewood. The fire burns as long as the wood's there. So as long as conditioning is there, that fire of knowledge is burning. And it burns it up till there is no more conditioning. Then from that state, then you either take up the knowledge of the devotional process and then continue through prema, or that's the end of the line, and then you just stay at that point. So you're between the two positions. Right? Does that make sense? So the jiva, their natural position is service to the Lord, so there's that small amount of pure bhakti that's there. So all living entities have that. The problem is because it's so small, and the purpose that they're using it is for something else, so what do you call it? You know what I'm saying? Just like, let's say, I forget what it was. They were called the... can't remember. But after the Second World War, then there were so many from the war, there were so... I may have done it before, but there was famous from that, that there were so many widows from the war. So that then people men would take advantage of this, find out who they are, then approach and, you know, make it seem like they knew the husband, they were friends of the husband, and get in close with them to the point where then it would end up with, you know, marriage. Then they would make joint accounts, and then they would kill their now wife, and then they would get the money. And this way, that was their occupation. Right? So, now, what are we using here? We're using the romantic element, you know, so the things with the flowers, nice talking, the considerations, you know, making the girl feel the center of attention, feel, you know, important, all that, right? Standard stuff. Is there any problem with that stuff? No. But what's their intent? It's simply an economic advantage. Right? And in a sinful way. It's not that, okay, I marry this rich girl and now we'll just live nicely as a couple. No, it's just simply they're trying to get the money. Right? Does this make sense? So, we're saying is that here you're taking proper romance, because otherwise it's working. Why? Otherwise it won't. If it's not proper, it won't work. Right? Does that make sense? Like that. So, that's pure romance mixed with economics. You understand? So that's what we mean by that pure devotion. Is the soul understands his higher powers, his higher elements like this, surrenders to that, applies themselves to that. That's the pure devotion. So that's what we mean, is that karma and jnana can't function without these principles, because karma and jnana come from the Lord. They're part of bhakti. They're servants of bhakti, secondary attributes of bhakti. So, if you want to get anything done, since the nature of the soul is service to the Lord, then you have to serve the Lord through applying it into the rules of the laws of nature. You know, you know, minimum, or according to how you say it? The Shastra, that's better position. Then you come as you come up. So therefore, each of these positions of Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha, then following the scripture, practicing those principles with that element of bhakti, you can get that result. Does that make sense? So that's just they're applying the form, even though they may not know the form at all. Then you have those who know the Vedic culture, so they know, they understand that form better. They'll practice it in a more standard way. They get better results. But they'll still only get the material results, since the end, what they want from using bhakti, is only karma and jnana. Right? Because as soon as bhakti has given that result, the bhakti disappears. Because why will you work more if you already have what you want? You know? How long do you cook? Till you have something to eat, not that you keep cooking. You understand? So that whole devotion to the cooking process lasts as long as you don't have something to eat. Once you have something to eat, then it stops. Does that make sense? And it might even be you were going to cook five things, but after cooking two things, then, you know, you want to eat. So then, you know, that bhakti goes away and then you eat. Does that make sense? Yeah. Does that make sense? So what we're talking about here? Yes.
From some charges, they define pure devotional service as pure unalloyed devotional service.
Yes, yes, yes.
And as you described it previously, that part is pure, but whatever impurities are there, so then it's like that.
That's the mix. Yeah. It's the same definition. Because what we're trying to attain is pure unalloyed bhakti, means the bhakti is not mixed with karma or jnana.
Yes.
But when we're saying here, there's a small... by the strength of a small amount of pure bhakti. It means because there is only pure bhakti. Bhakti means pure bhakti. Right? So that's why when we're on the platform mixed, we're called sadhana bhaktas. Because it's not pure. Right? But if you want to get into it in the full extent, then it's only prema as that. So you can say it's mixed with, it has that aspect of rati, but in other words, what is it mixed with? It's not technically mixed with karma jnana, but it's mixed with that neutrality. So the element of rasa hasn't come to its fullest position. Like you have the great sages and that, like on Tapaloka, then they'll be on that liberated platform. They know the Lord. They have that attraction to the Lord, but it's not that it's exclusive aspect of what do you call it? Possessiveness. So it's that they know the person's there, but it's not that the person is always the aspect that they're contemplating. They may be contemplating the aspects of the universal form. They know it's from the person, but they're more contemplating the mechanics of the universal form and how that masculine and feminine principles function. And doing that without attachment, it maintains them on the liberated platform. So it's not that they don't know the person. And it's not that they're not interested in the person. It's just that the person is not exclusive. In a sense, a very subtle point. That then, just with rati, then that puts them in shantaras, even though they don't have prema. But can be taken forward more to prema, where that's more strong, but it's still, there's no possessiveness. You know what I'm saying? So you do have these subtle elements. So before this point, it's not actually important to us. Right? Because just that understanding, that the principle as an understanding, then that's good enough, because that already is just, you know, farther ahead. But now, because we're studying at this point, now the secondary aspects of that primary principle, now we're distinguishing, so that we see the difference. Does that make sense? Otherwise, these great sages are liberated. They know about the Lord. They can think about the Lord and absorb themselves in the Lord. But why are they at that position? Because it doesn't have that possessiveness. Right? So it's not exclusive. So that aspect of Brahman, that aspect of Paramatma, that's there. So generally it's Paramatma is their main focus. So he's a person, but it's not about him as a person. But it's not that they have a problem with those elements. So we see then it's a higher level, like you see like Narad Muni, who is in that, but then they're in the platform of prema. So then the person is more important. But there's not that sense of possessiveness. And so then it, without that exclusion, it doesn't move on to servitorship. It's only with that, then there's that position. So in other words, what is, it's rasa. So in other words, it's rasa because they see themselves as the soul and the Lord as the, he's the Vishaya, they're the Ashraya, right? But that position of knowledge and all that, that's the interaction. So the knowledge about the Lord, the position of the Lord, the universal form of the Lord, you know, the position of liberation, all these things are the aspects that are the Udipan, right? You know, so the Alambana is there, but it's not, there's not that sense of possessiveness, so it doesn't take on servitorship. Does that make sense? Yeah, so that's why that's the fine points here. So what we're working with is pure bhakti, but when you mix it, then the effect, it's not pure. So what he's pointing out here is that basically that karma and jnana don't work without bhakti. So that bit of pure bhakti, which is the nature of the soul, is there. But because it's covered by that great amount of karma and jnana, we don't call it bhakti. Only when the purpose is bhakti. And so we're using that pure bhakti mixed with our, conditioning. Then we call that mixed devotional service. So if we're talking about the positive aspects, we call it karma yoga. Right? And so then it's positive because we're using it in a positive way. It's progressive. If we're getting stuck and we're not doing, then we'll say it's karma misra bhakti and we'll look at it in a negative light. You know, is that this aspect of karma being mixed with the pure bhakti is what's causing the problem. So, pure bhakti means where it's just the bhakti, no mix. Or it's so prominent, the bhakti, that you don't notice the other. It's not, it's like, does that make sense? It's like, that's the meaning of the bhasa. You know, it's like the sun hasn't come up, but basically it's fully light. So you have that understanding, that knowledge and everything, your position, your relationship with the Lord. It just hasn't come to that mature state yet. Does that make sense? So is that, are you all clear on this? So in these cases, we're talking about a small amount of pure bhakti. That means we're talking about the small amount, not the huge amount of jnana that it's mixed with. So that's why we'll say it's bhakti misra jnana. Right? So we see before is that the jnanis that can get to that liberated state. Now they're using bhakti misra karma, jnana, to get liberated. And so then how much effort has to be there? But it's going to be easier because of the bhakti. Right? But we call it bhakti misra jnana because as soon as they get the position of jnana liberation, they give up the bhakti. Right? Just that within their mind it's not important, it just disappears. But for the devotee, if he's on the platform doing the same functions, we'll say jnana misra bhakti. Means it's bhakti, it's the aspect of pure bhakti, but it's mixed with their attachment to jnana and their feelings for its liberation. But it's going to be more efficient because the amount of bhakti is greater, because bhakti is the dynamic element. Jnana and karma aren't dynamic, they're just mechanics. How do you make that work? It has to have that bhakti. Right? It's not that the science of the karma and jnana is what makes it work, it's the bhakti to it. So many people know the science, but they're not doing it. Does that make sense? You know, the couch potato, he does have a degree in law from the Harvard School of Law, but he's a couch potato. So he's getting no benefit from it. His friends harass him, everybody bothers him, but he likes sitting on the couch. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So that's the whole point, is it's not the knowledge itself. Right? And it's not just application. You can say, okay, we mix those two, but without the devotion, how are you going to have that continuous? Right? Because how do you get a result in bhakti? When does it come standard? When it's steady. Steady devotional service produces steady results. So whatever you want dharma, artha, karma, moksha, until it's steady, it's not going to give you results. So that means that element has to be steady. Right? Because the devotee is using it to please the Lord. Therefore, it's karma misra bhakti. It's bhakti with a mix of karma. But for the others, it's jnana and there's a mix of bhakti. But the path up to liberation, whether you're a jnana misra bhakta or a bhakti misra jnana, it's the same. That's why before when it was talking about it, it looks like it's talking about the devotees, but he was talking about the impersonalists in that. Right, in the previous purport, a few back. So that's because it's the same process. Yes?
We can always say it's the same process, but the emphasis is different.
Emphasis is different. That's why it's karma misra bhakti or bhakti misra karma, like this. It's whichever way you put it. It's just like two people are getting onto the bus, okay? One of the devotees is getting on the bus and Patol Sheth is getting onto the bus. Right? They're both going to Calcutta. They'll spend the day in the Calcutta and in the evening they'll get on the bus and come back to Mayapur. Okay? Now, is there going to be any difference in their getting on the bus, sitting on the bus, remaining on the bus till they get to the Calcutta, getting off the bus, then going doing their work, running around Calcutta, then getting back on the bus and coming back? Is there going to be any difference? How much they pay? No, it's all going to be the same. Right? They're all going to both sit in the same funky seats, bounce up and down, you know, as the wheels go around and the people go on the bus go up and down. It's all going to be the same, right? It doesn't change, right? All over the world, the same song is sung. It works. Why? Because it's one process. Okay? What's the difference? The devotee is going to Calcutta to get things for Krishna, right? While Mr. Sheth is going there and he's getting things for himself. Does that make sense? That's what we're talking about. So the process is the same. That's why we can look at either of them in a good way or in a negative way, depending on what the emphasis is of the subject matter. Does that make sense? So with this understanding, then you can appreciate what people are doing of value in devotional service. Otherwise, sometimes in preaching, whatever they're doing, their karma, it's all nonsense. Yes, as far as the benefit to the soul, it's all nonsense. But the mechanics of what they're using, there may be some valuable things, may not be valuable things. So you have to be able to distinguish what is valuable, what is not. Right? So the person's, you know, commitment, you know, their steadiness, you know, their reliability in whatever they're doing, that's good, because if they use that in devotional service, they'll get some real benefit. But that they're not doing devotional service, that's where the problem comes. Right? We're talking for the karma. Right? But those aspects, using those attributes and all that, those functions, those are functions of bhakti. Right? All qualities, all the superior qualities, are all coming from Krishna. They're all non-different from Krishna. So generally we think of a quality as this kind of, you know, how you say, subtle thing that you feel or something. But the point is if we take any quality, it means there must be an application. Right? Does that make sense? If someone is, okay, what's their quality? Commitment. So, how do you know that someone is committed? As a mood. By the activity that's done. So that means, commitment means they themselves are the ashray. What they're aiming that commitment towards is the vishay. You understand? So that's material rasa. So the qualities are important. You can't not have the qualities. We look at the mechanics so much that we forget that the quality is what actually is the point why the activity goes on. We think that just by the knowledge of Sankarshan, I will perform Abhideya and get Prayojana. I can if all I'm looking at is simply the external result. But the experience that will be gained from that result will be dependent upon what is the quality I use in Pajumna. So you can say, we don't worry about all these qualities, we just do it. But that's the move. I'm just being practical. So he's practical. But what does that practical mean? Is the practical including others, or the practical is just including themselves and their endeavor? So, therefore, you can say it's practical, but what's the whole point? It's only their own self-consideration. Right? So now, when you get the results, what is the nature of those results? It's only about themselves. Will anybody else appreciate it? No. And then they're going on, I did all this, I got all this result, how come nobody appreciates? Because he only appreciated himself, why should others appreciate? If he appreciated others in the process, or was considerate, then others would be in that mood, then be considerate in dealing with him. You understand? So you can't separate off the quality. The qualities are, what is the basis? That's why we say, what is the mood? So the mood is prema. That then, therefore, defines the ashray and vishay. And so what the experience will be. Does that make sense? So when we're on the platform of prema, then you say that's the full manifestation of spiritual rasa. Right? Then you'll have where there's a good understanding. Then you'll have just where there's a glimmer. Right? So in devotional service, what's being experienced is that glimmer. Right? Does that make sense? We do some devotional service. We worship the deity. We take part in something. And so what's the point? We're servant of the Lord. The Lord is... So we're the ashray of that mood of service. Right? The Lord is the vishay. He's where that service is directed. So that will naturally then give the aspects of anubhava. So therefore, the happiness that we gain, whatever things that might be there that we experience, though they're in a small amount, but they're still coming from that principle of spiritual rasa. The only point is that it will only be happening as long as we're doing that. You know what I'm saying? We're looking at the deity, that moods are there, we're feeling some happiness, And then, you know, our phone makes a particular sound, and then all focus goes on the phone. So now the point is, now we're the ashray and the phone is the vishay. And so then the rasa changes. And so we don't taste that other one anymore. It's not constant. When you come to the next level, that's constant, where it's always about, I'm the servant of the Lord and that. So that's what we're talking about, that continuous chanting and all these things. That's what makes the difference between this process being practiced in its natural state. And what we were saying before is the sahajiyas, they try to practice it at a higher level, at a lower state. They're not qualified. Or well, sometimes it's said, well, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has changed we've changed the method. The Bhaktivinoda Thakur is giving all these levels, but yes, you have to be at that point of constant chanting. Therefore, it means you're constant. Why would you be constantly chanting unless there's a constant appreciation of that relationship with the Lord? So that means that opening is there, but it's not complete. Does that make sense? It's because everybody does everything for rasa. Then when we drop below that, then it's about the person and something else. Then you have the material rasa. Right? So depending upon that, how much of the form you're using, until it gets down to total atheism, where it's basically hardly there. It's imperceptible. But that small amount of it, even that imperceptible amount of bhakti that's there, is enough to make the impersonalist their process work and get to liberation. Does that make sense? Here 1 second.
So you've mentioned this example several times. I've been listening to it over the years. Like, somebody's in the Grihastha park and they're observing Krishna and they're like happy to be mindful, and they drop the key. No, then they see someone that they don't like across the other way, and then they're like, oops, I dropped the keys, and now they're all about that, thinking about that.
Yeah.
Or you're absorbing the keys in your phone or whatever. So I want to know what that will look like. You know, like, you're absorbing the deity and then the phone goes, and then you're absorbing the keys to the phone, but someone that's on the level you're talking about, would they not have a phone anymore, or would they? What does it look like when they are absorbed and the phone goes off?
Okay. Would the phone be turned off even though they have the... So,
yeah.
Do they not have a phone? Is the phone turned off? Do they ignore it if it goes off?
Yeah, or do they still think
of Krishna? The point is, but what happens if it's... why would you have the phone?
Well, for your service.
Okay, so then therefore dealing with the phone is service. So
yeah.
Dealing with the Lord is service, dealing with the phone is service.
Okay.
But the point is then... Is the service that's coming up from the phone more important at this moment than the service that's being rendered to the deity?
We'll just say it is.
Okay, then you look at the phone, and what's the problem? It's just like this, if you want to go into another thing. Radharani in the evening after, means they've all come back from the fields, they've seen Krishna on his way into Nandagaon from the side. That creates this whole feeling of, they have that whole feeling of separation. That alleviates a little bit, but then it comes back again because Krishna goes into Vrindavan, and then they're trying to deal with that, but now it's time to cook for Krishna in the evening and arrange his bath. So then some of the gopis go, Radharani does not go. They go take the preparations that Radharani cooked, because she has to cook those things. She comes out of that mood of lamentation. She cooks those things nicely for Krishna, right? Then, having done that nice cooking for Krishna, that's sent with some of her assistants. They go there, they give Krishna's bath, they feed him in the evening. Like that, she doesn't go. Right? She stays back, and then they all get back, so now they're going to explain what happens. They all discuss all that, it's all very nice. Some will explain that, they'll sing something for Radharani, they'll do something like this, so there's always some kind of evening scene going on. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, would that be, you could say that would be, you know, a strong absorption in devotional service, yes or no? Okay? Now we see that some of them, knowing that the time is getting approaching for her taking rest, and if she doesn't take rest on time, she can't go and see Krishna on time, since that's actually the main program. Then they leave that wonderful assembly where it's so nice and interacting with Radharani. They go and get the bed ready and get everything ready for the evening. So the point is that if it's more important, then you do. If it's not, then why would you, you know? In other words, it's either you set your sounds so that you know that it's something important and other sounds means it's not, or you look and then decide.
Okay, I just.
But you just don't do your stuff that is not more important there in the temple that then why be there?
Yeah.
And then say it is service, but isn't you're being with the Lord? So unless it's something for the Lord that's more important at this point, then.
Yeah, I understand. Here it mentions that Jnana and Ajnana are the functions of the Maya Shakti.
Jnana and Ajnana are functions of Maya Shakti.
Yeah. And we also know that when we perform Bhakti, Jnana and Vairagya are the byproducts of it.
Yes.
So, can you say that this Jnana and Ajnana is basically speaking of Vidya and Avidya of Sri Shakti?
Which Jnana?
That is the products of Maya Shakti.
Yeah. It depends on how you're using it. So, because if we're saying vidyam cha in Upanishads, then we're meaning knowledge of the transcendental and knowledge of the material world. Right? And the knowledge of the material world, then there's the knowledge of karma and jnana. Right? So, what's going to liberate you in those aspects and what's going to give you favorable results in the performance of your activities.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's just a matter of which context you're dealing with at the time, which one you'll be using. You understand? What we have to get used to is that the same word, because it's based on the same principle, can be used in a variety of contexts. Right? So, like we said, is that the process of liberation is the same for the impersonalists and same for the devotees. It's not a different process. Right? Because Krishna says he has one path. So you're studying where you are, coming up to the point of liberation, it's one path. Coming up to the point of material facilities, it's one path. The point is, Krishna's path goes all the way to him. So someone who sees that path in relation to Krishna gets to Krishna. Someone who sees that path only in relation to liberation only gets to that far. Someone who sees the path only up to the heavenly planets only gets that far. Right? Everybody's becoming deathless. Amara, right? But some are eternally deathless, one's for a long time deathless, and one's for not as long, but a long compared to here. You understand? Yes, but it doesn't necessarily mean it may look like the bhakti we're practicing. Or it may not. It may just have the elements of it, but it's not, you understand? So there's a range of that. That's what we're saying, is that the person who is, means no karma and no jnana works without bhakti. But someone who's following the Vedic culture, who has that theistic element, you'll see more of that form. Just like the Smarta, he's interested in going to the heavenly planets. What time does he get up in the morning? Brahma Muhurta, right? Okay, what's he going to do after he gets up? He's going to take his bath. He's going to put on his tilak. He's going to wear his dhoti and chadar, right? He's going to have his thread on. He's going to chant his Gayatri. He's going to do his pujas and yajnas. You know, all the different things, circumambulating, whatever it is, offering obeisances, chanting the mantras. He's going to, many times we're using the same mantras. But the whole thing is simply worshipping the Lord to get that. Or they're using that process, but they're not worshipping Vishnu, they're worshipping Sun or Ganesh or Shakti or Shiva like this. But it's still the same process. All of them, all five, get up early in the morning. Right? Now let's say we go outside of that where they're just interested in the material benefits. Okay, in your traditional schools and music in India, what time do they get up? Again, Brahma Muhurta, right? And then what's their deity? Music. So they're practicing music at that time. So it's saying they're going to be following the same basic forms, the same commitment, but it's not that it's going to be progressive spiritually, right? But materially they'll get that benefit because they're using. So, in other words, why would we consider it like that? Because the nature of bhakti is inherent in the soul. Right? If it's not inherent in the soul, then why would we use that? Then we'd use the standard thing, is that if you're doing exactly what we're doing, you're living in the temple, you have a dhoti and kurta, you have a shaved head, you're following the full program, you're going out as sankirtan, okay, then it's devotional service, everything else is maya. But the point is that why does anything else work? Because you're dealing with the soul, you're dealing with God, you're dealing with his energy. It's God's energy, it's God's laws. So therefore, the living entity applies himself to that. So that means is that why would they do that? Because that's what's inherent in the soul. The nature to serve is what's inherent. So in other words, anyone gets anything in this world because they're rendering service. Right? So that's what you do. Is that it doesn't matter what you're doing, even if it's something, you know, strange, but you're rendering service to, like the cook. He's rendering service to the pots and the fire and the vegetables and the utensils. You know, and serving the cooking process. He's devoting himself to that. So he follows it very properly. Right? So whatever's the potity for cooking, he's following. He's not doing something weird. Right? Does that make sense? Right.
And sometimes devotees, they say that this is material drive, it's material.
It is material because the result is material. What we're talking about here is what are we looking at? We're looking at why are they successful? Because of that natural element of bhakti in the soul. Though the soul is in complete ignorance of the Lord. Right? In other words, technically speaking, all there is bhakti in the creation. But now whether it's in the platform of prema, whether there's some, you know, strong understanding of the Lord, there's a glimmer of understanding, then that glimmer is now in negative. It's not in, you know, not conscious. In other words, it's not necessarily theistic, or it is, but it's quasi-theistic, right? So it's not really about the Lord. Then it's really removed from that, and then it's totally atheistic. But the point is even an atheist is getting his results because of his commitment and devotion to it. He has to devote himself that whoever he sees, whoever he meets, he has to explain to them there's no God. You understand? So that's the whole point. So that's what we're talking about here, is that's the point that we're bringing out, we're approaching when we're dealing with the preaching. Right? So in other words, the atheist is so committed. He meets that, he discusses it, so that's what keeps him absorbed, inspired. So that means, but he's not satisfied. Why not? So it's not because he's meeting people, discussing, you know, what he understands in the philosophy. He's trying to live that lifestyle himself and commit to that. That's not what's causing the problems, because it's atheistic. He's leaving the Lord out of it. But he's using that process of bhakti to that very minuscule degree. Now, if he simply adds the Lord to that, now everyone he sees and meets, he talks about the Lord. And he lives his lifestyle and connects with the Lord. He'll progress very fast, because his commitment to that aspect of bhakti, though material, is, you understand? But we don't use this in general discussions, because it gets confusing. What we're using it in here is understand what is making things work. Because all souls are servants of the Lord. So that's the point. Looking at it from the mode of goodness, then all souls are part of the Lord. Therefore, we can see everybody in connection with the Lord. So whatever they're doing, we can see the connection to the Lord. That's the part you have to take, not the external. Using this understanding on a lower level of consciousness, then you end up with, it's the external that's important. So I can't change the Western externals or the Vedic, you know, the smart externals. I can't change those. I have to keep those exactly the way they are. So he continues to worship Ganesh, and just, you know, within his heart he thinks of Vishnu. So we just think that that's what the thing, rather than it's the consciousness that we're working on. And then you take that principle. He's worshiping Ganesh, worship Vishnu. Right? You're following all these rules and social things like that. The Vedas also point this out. That's why it's there. You know, people say, well, you know, I got to be practical. I can't just do devotional service all day. I have to, you know, have a job. But who says that you have a job? Right? Does the modern society, is there a law you have to have a job? No, there can't be, because if there is, then most all governments of the world, at least 40% of the time, are you know, how you say, criminal. Because if it was everybody has to have a job, that means it's the law, the government has to pursue that, there would be full employment. But some places there's 40% unemployment. That means it's not a law, just it's a common practice. But in the Vedic culture, it's a law. You have to have an occupation. That's varna, avat, and ashram. So you have to situate yourself, and you have to have an occupation. So that, oh, I have to be practical, I have to make money. That's God's law, not a modern law. This is what we're trying to get at, is that the Vedic, because of this, these fine understandings, it's the position from which you can deal and approach anyone, because it is universal. People can say what they like. It's the only thing that seems universal. Everything else is regional. Absolutely everything else. And regions within regions within regions, within this block, within this house, within this bedroom, within this house. So it's not universal at all. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? What is it? Well, you know, if we get... At what point do they kind of... I think it's like 10,000 hits, then you kind of consider... Huh? It's viral at 10,000. Okay, how many people on the internet? 3 billion. So 10,000 out of 3 billion.
What's consumption?
Huh? 10,000. We would consider it went viral. Right? 10,000 people out of 3 billion. That's nothing. Right? 300 billion is 1%. You know? So that means a tenth of the cents would be 30 billion. You know, a hundredth of a percent would be 3 billion. No? 3? Or 300,000. So, I mean, it's like we're talking about, you know, a 10,000th of a percent, and we call it viral, and everyone, wow! It's nothing. You understand? So this whole thing is that, you know, but so many people... It's not so many people. What are these so many people? You know what I'm saying? If we say within the community of devotees there's 10,000, okay, now it's you're talking about a lot higher percentage. But within the karmic world, it's not... You understand? So this whole thing is that this universal, you know, like that, that's... it's no, it's not. Yes? Sin. Buddhist background. Yes, yes. No, but the point is the basic principle is whatever is your concept of the supreme, right? All religions have a concept of the supreme. And they all have a concept of the practitioner of the rules and regulations of the supreme, right? So following those rules, that's piety. Not following those rules, that's impiety. So that definition, that works for everybody.
And when Christians say that, you offend God and then you start sinning, but I come from Buddhism, we have no God, how can you offend God?
Yeah, but you can offend the concept of no God.
What?
By saying there's God, yeah. So you understand? So there's always that element of supreme. Because otherwise, if there's no God and there's nothing, then why is it considered so pious within Buddhism to be nice and give in charity and do all those nice, nice stuff? Right? Because if you have a Buddhist monk, you expect him to be really nice. But if it's all illusion, doesn't exist, what does it matter? You understand? So the point is there must be some aspect of supreme. Otherwise, how do you describe that, okay, being humble, or having no possessions, or being knowledgeable, right, or being detached, are good, unless they're compared to something compared to the supreme. You understand? Yeah, but the other one is that you'll extinguish yourself forever, or you'll be stuck here forever. In either case, then it's according to their position, they figure that's tough. You want to be stuck here in the material world forever? No, that's hellish. So then it's the same principle. It's all the same. It's just how you present it. Okay, it's just like, okay, let us say, okay, have you ever seen, a bamboo stick? On that bamboo stick, there's maybe like, let's say, crickets, and those crickets have been deep fried. Right? Okay. Now, in some places, that'll be considered a nice, tasty, crunchy snack. In other places of the world, that will be disgusting. But what's the principle? Principle of cooking and eating. So, in other words, it's just various ways to attain that state. You understand? So, the principles on which religion works is one thing. It's just its application is different. It's the main thing is to talk about the principles of which it functions, because those are universal. Those will apply to all religions. So when that's understood, then you can see what would be the... So since I want to establish a relationship with that Supreme, what would be the best lifestyle? Since the Lord is a person, doesn't eat deep-fried crickets, therefore that would not be favorable in the performance of my duties to offer things to him in service. Does that make sense? Yeah. That's why then we use this life. That's why we say the Vedic is a universal lifestyle. You can make it regional and make it mundane, but it itself is not. Just like, because if we say, they're also, just make it mundane, but the point is what is being made mundane? The eternal. So the soul is eternal, the Vedas are eternal, the process is eternal, bhakti is eternal, but people are using this for material purpose. Dharma, artha, karma, and moksha, according to the modes, according to their taste, then it will have more piety or less piety, more theistic, less theistic. Right? So that will go on. But the point is that it's all about the Lord. So then if it's about favorable to the Lord, we would choose according to the Lord's taste, not according to ours. Because the point is, we have some principles. Right? Does that make sense? But that's why the scriptures are there. You have to follow scripture. Just like you're going to be a good Buddhist, there are scriptures. You have to follow authority. Right? The scripture is there, then the great authorities are there, we follow them. So therefore the Vedas are there, and the authorities to give that is there. Does that make sense? Yeah. Doesn't make sense? Okay, yes. Okay. Okay. When the coverings are removed by perfection of jnana mixed with bhakti, one attains the stage of Brahma-Bhuta, the form of Brahman as pure consciousness without coverings. Then, with the disappearance of jnana, which is like a fire which disappears without fuel, he attains bhakti, which was included in jnana, but which is indestructible, since it belongs to the Lord Swarup Shakti, and is different from Maya Shakti, right? So in other words, if that's there when you get to the point of the Brahma-Bhuta stage, means the bhakti remains, the jnana disappears, because it was burning up the material concept. Right? So that remains there. And so that's then where you take up devotional service. Right? Does that make sense?
About which jnana are we talking that disappears?
The jnana about how of dealing with the conditioning, how that works, right? How to engage the conditioning without attachment, right? The rules and regulations, how that functions, all that is true. That's why the uttama to preach comes as a madhyama, so they have to accept that body of knowledge to function. Otherwise, then if they function the way they function, how many people would necessarily be taking up devotional service if everybody was following the lifestyle of the Python Sadhu. You understand? Yeah, so that's the... Jnana and Tattva. Because Tattva is all knowledge, but the point is when it's connected to the Lord, then that doesn't disappear. The particular mechanics that we need to use for engaging our conditioning, that may not be so important or prominent anymore. Right? So what we use and what we practice then will be what is there in the relationship of the constitutional nature of the living entity connected to the Lord. Right? So, in other words, that knowledge how to engage the conditional in the pursuance of the constitutional, that goes because you don't need it anymore. Right? Does that make sense? You know, it's just like, okay, I get a new gizmo, right? And I get with that a manual how to use that gizmo. So now I'll read that gizmo and use that knowledge to be able to set up the gizmo and do all those things. But once after that, I just run the gizmo and just, that's all the more I use. So all that knowledge before, you can say, is given up because it's not needed anymore.
So, yeah. Is it like you are able to describe, you know, the vision that first is Bhakti Nishradhan knows, then Jnana Nishradhan, and then pure?
It can be, but what we're talking about is it's the same process.
Yeah.
So whether it's Jnana Misra Bhakti or Bhakti Misra Jnana, that it doesn't matter. The process of getting to this point is there. Now the question is do they want to continue with that? That's why the focus has to be on pure bhakti. We make it upon renunciation, knowledge, detachment, all these kind of things. Then when we get to that liberated position, we may not continue with the bhakti. Does that make sense? So that's why we, how do you say, we have to be careful of that. So for us, we're only going to use it in this way. But what we're talking about is for the jnani, that if you're dealing with a jnani, then in their position, then they just have to add this devotional element in consciously to make it function, then they'll get to the same position. That's why in Krishna Gita says that the yogi and the bhakti, they both bhakta, they get to the same platform, right? But how they go about getting there, then that has that aspect of the secondary difference. The primary of those positions in Ashtanga Yoga are the same, but how you perform them, that will be different. The secondary will be different, right? So they'll get to the same principle. So if you understand it's about the Lord, that'll get you there. If not, they'll simply get to the liberated platform and then it will stop. So since we're not interested in that, then we're not dealing with that. But the point is then if you're looking at it from pure bhakti, because this is Vishwanath, right?
Yes.
If you're looking at it from pure bhakti, then technically what are we? Because if we say bhakti starts at prema, then what are we? Then we're a bhakti misrajani. You know what I'm saying? So generally when we're using the terms, we're using it more from Baladev's position, which means we're, you know, Jnana Misra Bhaktas. You understand? But if you're looking at it from simply the pure bhakti in its way, then it says, that's why he's going to go on and say this. He's going to go on and say he attains pure bhakti rather than he performs. So that means he hasn't up to this point actually performed. He attains that. So that little bit that's there, that brings us to the point. It's just a matter of how much we take it. Because if we take it from, we haven't come to that point, then that means then we're going to be, you know, very particular to see that we're performing pure bhakti. Right? Well, if we put it on the other side, then you know, how you say, then there's going to be the aspect of, yeah, no, we're devotees, everything's cool. Right? Now, so for that weakness, then you say, what we're dealing at the aspect of actually bhakti misra jnana. So then, as we have to be more serious, But if we said, oh, but we're only in Bhakti Misigyan, how it's so far away, how will I ever get there? No, because it's, you know, it's devotion is the main, that's your intent, so therefore we look at it as Bhakti Misra, I mean, Karma, Jnana Misra Bhakti. Is that, you know, it's there, it's the Bhakti, is, you know, it's saying. So it's depending upon the mentality. So in other words, if that sincerity is there, that humility is there, then it's Jnana Misra Bhakti. If we become proud, then it's Bhakti Misra Jnana, because where's the Bhakti if we're proud? Does that make sense? So the process is the same, but he's describing it here. He gets to this point so he could continue from this point. Because remember that the point made before that's being made here, and I think it's even being made in the Bhagavatam, is that one comes to the liberated platform. From there, then you can take up actually Bhakti. So that's why before that it's called sadhana bhakti, bhakti in practice. But taking up bhakti where you are actually performing bhakti or attaining pure bhakti, that happens after you're liberated. Right? So, but we will say is that that point of where that performance of bhakti, whatever it is, to please the Lord, but it becomes steady. Right, that it's steady means there's progress, you're trying to please the Lord. We'll call that the beginning of pure devotional service. So we'll say the madhyama, that's pure devotional service. You know, as a standard in general. Because then you would say all madhyama bhaktis are performing pure devotional service. But it's mixed. But because it's prominent, therefore we'll say 75%, then that's, right? So then we'll say that's good. You understand? So we have to see the context in which they're using it. If we just stick to the words themselves and we have a fixed concept, that's where the problem comes in. So when the acharyas broaden our understanding as we go through the Bhagavatam, we go through step by step these things, and we broaden it, like now, in this section, we broaden it that words that are generally used in one way, standard, are used in another way. Then it's to broaden our understanding, because that's the whole thing. No, but it means this. The words, these syllables mean this. But no, they're only describing a principle. But we only know the secondary of that principle in these ways. It's showing there's a wider range of ways. But it takes more maturity to appreciate that. Is that what it says? Okay, but bhakti, since it belongs to the Lord Sarup Shakti and is different from Maya Shakti, it does not disappear with the disappearance of vidya and avidya. Thus he attained pure bhakti, devoid of karma, jnana and karma. Previously, a small amount of bhakti used for achieving liberation through jnana and vairagya was not visible, though it was present like paramatma. The verse says he attains pure bhakti rather than he performs pure bhakti. It is just like a jewel which, though covered by grains, is not destroyed when the grains are destroyed in time, and then becomes visible. But it is not possible for that person to attain full prema bhakti at that time, or even merging. Thus, param should not be explained as prema bhakti. Right? So that's what we're saying, where you're getting up to this liberated position. But it's not that we're striving for liberation. That also cannot be made as a mistake. Is that we're only striving for pure devotional service. But the liberation, as we said, comes as a side effect. Performance of karma, that gives you whatever facilities you require to maintain body and soul together. Performance of the jnana, that will bring you to the liberated platform. That's just the side benefits of these two. They happen anyway. We're only interested in pure devotional service. So, but we're pointing out is until you get to that liberated platform, then that dynamic aspect of bhakti on the level of prema won't take place, because prema is happening at the level of liberation. You understand? It's not because of liberation, that's just the platform on which it happens. Just like you want to catch the train, you get to the station. Let's say, okay, I'm taking the train to Delhi. Okay? Now, when I leave here and get on the car or bus, or I even just walk out of the house, will I say I'm on the journey to Delhi? Yes. But when do we say that journey seriously starts taking place? When we get to the station. So that's what we mean. Liberation means now in that position of actually being in the sarup that I am serving the Lord, we don't have a material designation. Then it starts, right? Because then now I see myself as servant. that matures, then I see myself as assistant to the servants that are there. That brings to the point where then I am myself can be a servant of the Lord. Then you can say, now the surup is siddhi. But now that has to come to the platform of prema. Then you can say, now it's actually perfect, because that's vastu siddhi. Because vastu means substance. So we've got the surup, but it's not the substance. So just having the surup, then also when you're comparing the prema, is not that big of a deal, right? Sahaja is making it into a super big deal. We don't. It's just one of the stages. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, yeah. What happens to the person with bhakti? A particular example is given. Either the jnani or various types of devotees who know me as I am, know me in truth by bhakti. Right? So here, another way we can also mention about jnani is, if we're looking at it from the devotional point of view, then in when Krishna describes the four kinds of pious persons, the jnani is one who wants to know the Lord. But it's about knowledge and those practices, what are favorable for knowing the Lord and not favorable. So that naturally has to come through into a higher platform of pure devotion. Because that's not considered pure devotion, right? Because it's about knowing the Lord rather than serving the Lord. I mean, it's service in that you're learning about the Lord, hearing and chanting, but it's just to gain knowledge rather than to apply that knowledge. That's why it's considered within the pious, right? So therefore, getting to know the Lord, we will take it that devotee means one who wants to know Bhagavan, but he may want to know Paramatma, or may want to know Brahman. So in that way, we can say it's bhakti. You understand? Or for the karmi, he may have those positions, but wants his karma, or he may just understand the laws of nature. So at least he's accepting the Lord in that form, and then that bhakti that's applied. Does this make sense?
Yeah. Honestly, in the Bhagavad, we came across the
Tattva-darshi.
Yes, so you're even a jnani is one.
Jnani is a tattva-darshi, but what aspect of tattva? The tattva he knows is only Brahman. Yeah. You understand? But Brahman is one of the features of Krishna. Yeah. So we're just saying is that if it's about Bhagavan, that's what we'll say is, now that's properly situated devotee. Mm-hmm. But what our realization is, it may be on a lower level, but that's our goal. But if your goal is only Brahman or Paramatma, that's less of a goal. If your goal is not even that, you know God's there, but you just want the material facility, then it puts you down into the karma, and so then it'll make it less. That's why we say, we see as the jnanis and the bhaktas, then they're in one, they're both considered transcendentalists. But the karmis, then in a lower level, that's mundane, however you cut it. Right? Then within that, there's those who are theistic and atheistic. So even the atheistic, if they want to do, then they have faith in the laws of nature. Right? Does that make sense? And then if not, then the gross, they just have faith in their, you know, what they perceive. But who is the function of the senses? Who is the sense? Who is the sense object? Right? You understand? So who is the working of that? That's still Krishna. So they have faith in that. So everybody has faith in Krishna. Everybody's seeing Krishna, just that they don't necessarily... So we'll say when someone accepts that position of the Lord as Bhagavan, then we'll say, then that's proper, you say, Vaishnava. But before that, the jnanis, the yogis, they accept Paramatma Brahman. So in that way, they're accepting the Lord. They're rendering that aspect of bhakti. But we don't really call them devotees. We'll say the jnanis, the yogis. But when we accept him as a person, then we'll say that's bhaktis, bhakta. Now within that, then you have neophyte, madhyama, and uttama. And then within uttama, then you have, you know, the rati, and then prema, and then beyond prema. So there's always going to be those aspects, right? And it will stop.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Śrīla Prabhupāda ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Prabhupāda ki.